So, as I said, yesterday, there's not going to be a test. So don't worry, you know, if you feel a little overwhelmed by Dogen. But I hope that, I think the purpose, the reason we have these retreats is to just help people be a little less intimidated by Dogen and feel, you know, and become acquainted and maybe just take a few Dharma bits and pieces, pearls, home that will nourish your practice. So let's start right in with the next section of the text. But first, we'll just look at the cast of characters, because this is one of those old stories from the Tang Dynasty, from the koan literature. So there are three great Zen masters here from the Golden Age of Chan. Chan is just the Chinese for Zen. And for anybody who's quite new to all this, Chan or Zen just means meditation, jhana in the Sanskrit. So we have Shirto and Mazu, who were contemporaries, two of the greats, with very different styles of teaching. Shirto was very contemplative and subtle, and Mazu was vigorous and liked to yell and hit a lot to wake his students up. And Yaoshan, who would later become renowned in his own right, practiced first with Shirto and then with Mazu. So here's how it goes. Would someone read? This is, we're at section 16. Would someone read that for us, Carmen?
Yaoshan, who would later become great master Hong Dao, instructed by Shirto, great master Wuji, once went to study with Mazu, Zen master Daji of Jiangxi. Yaoshan asked, "I'm familiar with the teaching of the three vehicles and 12 divisions of scripture, but what is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from India?" Mazu replied,
You can skip for the time being.
Okay. Yeah. "Sometimes have him raise his eyebrows and blink. Sometimes do not have him raise his eyebrows and blink. Sometimes to have him raise his eyebrows and blink is right. Sometimes to have him raise his eyebrows and blink is not right." Hearing these words, Yaoshan experienced great enlightenment. "When I was studying with Shirto, it was like a mosquito trying to bite an iron bowl."
This is how it always goes. Hearing those words, he achieved great enlightenment. And this has, you know, been sort of a blessing and a curse to everyone ever since, because people think that that's what's supposed to happen. So, of course, you know, these are teaching stories. And Yaoshan probably did have a being moment, a moment of being time. Upon hearing those words. So he asked that question, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from India? And as I think most of you know, Bodhidharma, it was the legendary Indian monk who came to China in the 5th century and founded Zen, as it said. He didn't really found Zen. He started practicing and people came and practiced with him, and it became the Zen school after several generations, identified as such. But what is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from India is sort of a code in the koan literature for what is the point of all this. It's just like sometimes it's, what is Buddha? You know, there are similar questions, and they're almost impossible to answer. And so there have been many answers, mostly non-rational, such as 3 pounds of flax, or the cypress tree in the courtyard, or the cow has given birth, take good care of it, or pass the cushion, at which point the Zen master whacks the student with the cushion. Wouldn't hurt with this one. But in this case, Mazu gives a longer, more complex answer than is typical. He says, sometimes have him raise his eyebrows and blink, sometimes do not have him raise his eyebrows and blink, sometimes to have him raise his eyebrows and blink is right, and sometimes it is not right. Dogen quotes these lines. If you look in the Japanese, he gives these lines in Chinese, so it's like a direct quote. And the Chinese grammar leaves ambiguous who is causing whom to raise the eyebrows and blink. It could be these old Zen masters, it could be us. It could be a reference to the story of Buddha's first Dharma transmission to Mahakashapa that I mentioned this morning, where the Buddha held up the flower and twirled it, and it's said that he raised his eyebrows and blinked when he did that. So it could be a reference to that story. And as you remember, Mahakashapa, only one of the disciples, seeing the flower, smiled. And the Buddha said, I have the treasury of the true Dharma eye, and I entrust it to you. So that was said to be the first Dharma transmission. So you see, Dogen didn't invent the phrase treasury of the true Dharma eye. It goes way, way back. That's what the compilation of Dogen's writings is called, Shobo Genzo, treasury of the true Dharma eye, but that is a very old expression. Anyway, the story itself isn't the point here. We don't really need to worry too much about it. The structure is what's the point. Mazu is using it to present what is called a tetralemma. A tetralemma is a fourfold logical proposition. And he's presenting this to Yaoshan. What the story, and I'll come back to that in a minute, what the story does depict or suggest is an interaction, something that invokes a response, this raising the eyebrows and blinking the eyes is invoking a response or not. You know, it may or it may not. And it may be right or wrong, either way. So we've got these four propositions. Mazu might have continued his presentation with, sometimes not to have him raise his eyebrows and blink is right. Sometimes not to have him raise his eyebrows and blink is not right. See, turning it and turning it. And that's exactly what Dogen does in the next section. He takes it to... So let's just keep going, and I'll come back to the tetralemma. Okay? So, if somebody could read 17. Yeah, Judy?
What Mazu said is not the same as other people's words. The eyebrows and eyes are mountains and oceans, because mountains and oceans are eyebrows and eyes. Have him raise his eyebrows is to see the mountains. Have him blink is to understand the oceans. The right answer belongs to him, and he is activated by your having him raise his eyebrows and blink. Not right does not mean not having him raise his eyebrows and blink. Not to have him raise his eyebrows and blink does not mean not right. These are all equally being time. Mountains are time. Oceans are time. If they were not time, there would be no mountains, or oceans. Do not think that mountains and oceans here and now are not time. If time is annihilated, mountains and oceans are annihilated. As time is not annihilated, mountains and oceans are not annihilated. This being so, the morning star appears, the Tathagata appears, the eye appears, and holding up a flower appears. Each is time. If it were not time, it could not be thus.
Thank you. Now listening to that, you may feel like Yaoshan, like you're a mosquito trying to bite an iron bowl. But let's remember what Dogen's been saying all this time about being time. He's suggesting here that the being time of raised eyebrows and blinking, this is a moment of recognition between two people. And that moment of recognition between two people is so vast, it's connected to mountains and oceans. It includes mountains and oceans, which means everything, right? That moment of recognition. In one moment of call and response, that one moment of call and response may be right, and in another moment it may be wrong. You know, we don't know for sure when we call out and get a response if it's going to be what we wanted, what we anticipated, or not. You know, it might go right off the rails. We don't know, right? And yet, in another moment of being time equally vast, the exchange may not result in a call and response. It might not even happen, or it might miss, right? And that might be right or not. That too might be right or not. Each of these moments of being time is just that unique moment of suchness, of meeting. You know, within what we've been saying, that vastness of interconnected phenomena, mountains and oceans. And out of this realization, the morning star appears, the Buddha awakens, someone holds up a wildflower, someone else sees the universe in it. Okay, Dogen keeps going with this. And this time he's going to quote another Chinese Zen master of old, Shu Xian, Zen master Guixin. So who would read that for us? Colleen, would you read that one? 18?
Yes.
Yeah. She's busy writing.
Yes.
Okay.
Shu Xian, Zen master Guixin, is an heir of Shushan and a Dharma descendant of Linji. Is that right pronunciation?
Mm-hmm. Linji, yeah.
Linji. One day he taught the assembly. For the time being, mind arrives.
Oh, I missed that one.
For being time, mind arrives, but words do not. For being time, words arrive, but mind does not. For being time.
Oh, okay. Let's go back.
Okay.
What I did here was something different. So
that
threw you. I'm substituting this time sometimes.
Okay.
Okay.
Should I read them all as sometimes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll tell you why.
Shushan, Zen master Guixin, is an heir of Shushan and a Dharma descendant of Linji. One day he taught the assembly. Sometimes mind arrives, but words do not. Sometimes words arrive, but mind does not. Sometimes both mind and words arrive. Sometimes neither mind nor words arrive.
Okay, thank you. And I just changed it this time, instead of saying being time, because it didn't, it's, for one thing, it sounds funny. You could also just say being time. But because Dogen At least in this version I have, wrote it out as arutoki in the which is the Japanese idiom for sometimes. So I think it's okay for us to use sometimes here, but it has a little bit different feeling than for the time being. But we won't worry about it. The point is now that he's setting out this tetralemma. And this time, he's showing us the being-time nature of, he's talking about mind and words. You know, so mind, what we understand, and words, our ability to express it. Right? So we all know what a dilemma or dilemma is, right? In logic, it's a choice posed between two unsatisfactory options, right? You're on the horns of a dilemma, right? Neither one is satisfactory. So tetralemma is a formulation, and it's used a lot in Indian systems of logic that goes something like this. This is true, this is not true, this is both true and not true, or and this is neither true nor not true. Okay? These aren't all exact, these are all tetralemmas. They're not all exactly like that, but they're all variations on that. So the classic Buddhist tetralemma goes back to the 2nd century Indian philosopher and sage Nagarjuna, who taught, he was one of the early Mahayana thinkers who taught the two truths that we've been talking about, of the absolute and the relative, right? The oneness and the oneness and differentiation. There's different, which are not separate, they're simultaneous, right? And this is and is closely related to what Dogen's been talking about all along with being time. So Nagarjuna's tetralemma is this: all things exist, all things do not exist, all things both exist and do not exist, and all things neither exist nor do not exist. So Guixing's tetralemma about mind and words could be understood from the relative or the absolute point of view. From the relative point of view, he seems to be describing sort of stages of attainment. Sometimes your mind is awakened, but you can't express it. Sometimes we express or respond to the moment, but we don't even understand what it is we're doing, you know, that what we've done. Sometimes our awareness and our expression are simultaneous, and sometimes we just don't get it. There's no awareness or expression, right? So he could be describing these as almost stages. Tom Wright and Shohaku Okamura's translation of that very same tetralemma gives us a little bit of a more metaphorical wrong book. A bit of a metaphorical expression of that same tetralemma. They say, though the aim hits the mark, okay, imagine bow and arrow, though the aim hits the mark, the expression may fall short. So we have an intention, but we don't hit the mark, right? The expression may fall short. Though the expression hits the mark, the aim may be off, right? Aim and expression sometimes both hit the mark. Sometimes both fall short. So that's, I find that visual image of the, you know, hitting the target helps us with that. The intention and then the actual expression of hitting the mark. There's a Buddhist scholar named Joan Stambaugh who I was not familiar with until I read this book, and I still have to would like to track down her work. She apparently wrote a book called Impermanence in Buddha Nature. And I like her commentary on this tetralemma. She says, one might say Dogen does his own Uji version of Nagarjuna's tetralemma. Whereas Nagarjuna had exhausted the possibilities of assertion and denial, showing that all four were false, Dogen gives us two versions of the tetralemma and then modifies them. Nagarjuna had stated that you cannot say anything. Dogen goes beyond this to make different statements, none of which is true to the exclusion of the others. They are all true sometimes, which is another way of saying that each one is being time. So Dogen is going a little further than Nagarjuna does, which opens up a kind of freedom. In the next passage, Dogen takes the absolute, all-inclusive view to show us that each of the four tetralemma propositions is a dharma position in being time, right? We've been talking about these dharma positions, these moments of being time. And so Dogen's saying each of these is that. Beyond evaluation, beyond judgment. You know, we can't say one is better or worse than the other. They are each a moment of being time, life as it is. Okay, section 19. Who would read that for us? Yeah. Chenille?
Second paragraph.
18. Uh-oh, I think my numbering might be off. The one that says both mind and words, are being time.
Both mind and words are being time. Both arriving and not arriving are being time. When the moment of arriving has not appeared, the moment of not arriving is here. Mind is a donkey that has not yet left. Words are a horse that has already arrived. Having already arrived is words, and not having left is mind. Arriving is not coming. Not arriving is not yet.
Yeah. So he's playing. He's playing with this tetralemma form here to drive home his point about being time being non-linear and multi-directional, dynamic, impossible to pin down. So mind as the donkey, expression, words as the horse, may be a reference to another famous koan dialogue. The monk asks his teacher, what is the essential meaning of Buddha Dharma? So that's the same thing as asking, why did Bodhidharma come from the West? The teacher answered, when the donkey matter has not yet left, the horse matter arrives. We could say that this describes the interpenetrating nature of being time, past, present, and future, merging in this dharma position. We don't have to judge the donkey for still not being a horse, or the horse for backsliding into donkey behavior. Okay, remember the donkey is the make sure I get this right to not confuse you further. The donkey as the mind intending, the horse as the expression. Yeah. And is there a clear point where the The donkey becomes the horse? Not really. And once a horse? Are you a horse for always and ever? No, of course we backslide all the time. We mess up in our expression, right? Is that making sense a little bit?
Yeah. I'm a little hung up still on your translation of being time into sometimes, like in that previous paragraph. I'm just sort of wondering why that is, because when we say sometimes, it's as if we're talking about like multiple different times.
Yeah, I did it to just, because Dogen did.
Sometimes?
It's the one place where he changed it from Uji to Arutoki.
Oh.
And I'm not... Arutoki is the usual way of reading this. It would look a little different. I could say that to anybody in ordinary contemporary Japanese, and they would, if I said Arutoki, they would know I meant sometimes or once. If I said Uji, they'd kind of stare at me and what are you talking about? It's used in this Buddhist context, in this Zen context, and ordinary people wouldn't know what I was talking about. Yeah. So for our purposes, it's fine to stick with being time. For this too. Yeah.
Does he write it in Furigana?
Yeah.
Huh.
No, he writes Aru in Hiragana and then Toki as time. Which is probably often how it would be written in a Japanese if you're looking at a storybook or something. Did Dogen put that I'm not sure if the editors. So let's not get hung up on it. Dogen is getting to the kind of punchline of this whole discourse here. Believe it or not. The message that our wholehearted effort in each moment is necessary, matters, makes a difference to all beings. He's really actually saying something real about our everyday lives, even though this sounds like wild philosophical language. He's saying something very down to earth. And the ultimate point of Nagarjuna's use of the Tetralemma in a treatise that's called the Mula Majjhimika Karika. I managed to say that. The fundamental verses of the middle way. This is about the middle way. This is about, he's making the case for the middle path as the life of a bodhisattva, not getting stuck in the absolute, not getting stuck in the relative everyday details. That's how a bodhisattva has to live, not getting stuck. Being able, having the flexibility to enter all those realms, you know, the hell realm, the animal realm, the Ashura realm of Donald Trump, right? We have to be able to enter all those realms without getting snagged and entrapped. With a wise and compassionate heart and mind. That's what he's saying here, is how to walk the middle path of the bodhisattva. So let's read. I think my numbers might be messed up. The paragraph that says, being time is like this. Arriving is hindered. Somebody read that one? Yeah, Greg?
Being time is like this. Arriving is fulfilled by arriving.
Let's use hindered. Skip. Uh-oh.
We have fulfilled by arriving.
Okay. Is it too hard for you to, every time it says fulfilled, to substitute hindered?
Hindered.
Everybody write that down.
We always say every day.
I don't know why he translated this. Am I going on record? I'm recording. I really don't understand why he used fulfilled here. I'll come to that after. Can you read it as hindered?
Being time is like this. Arriving is hindered by arriving, but not by not arriving. Not arriving is hindered by not arriving, but not by arriving. Mind hinders mind and sees mind. Words hinder words and see words. Hindering hinders sees hindering. Hindering is nothing but hindering. This is time. As hindering is caused by you, there is no hindering that is separate from you. Thus you go out and meet someone. Someone meets someone. You meet yourself. Going out meets going out. If these do not actualize time, they cannot be thus.
Well done. This is a tricky passage. because of this difficult to translate word, kege. And we chanted it twice. We chanted it in English yesterday in the Heart Sutra, and we chanted it in Sino-Japanese today. In the Heart Sutra goes, it's a Buddhist term. You will not find this in a modern Japanese dictionary.
It's the character.
Oh, I'd have to show you in a Japanese chant book. I wish I had it. I don't know if we have one. So when we chant the Heart Sutra, imu sho toko bodai satai hanya haramita koshi mu kege mu kege. Okay. And the English is, with nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on prajna paramita, and thus the mind is without hindrance. Without hindrance, there is no fear. Far beyond all inverted views, one realizes nirvana. This is a really key passage. Thus the mind is without hindrance. Without hindrance, there is no fear. Right? When we rely on prajna, prajna wisdom. So what on earth is Dogen saying here? I'm going to call on Chinchu Roberts. She did all this work in this book, and I haven't quoted her directly yet, because I really like her commentary on this. She is saying, Dogen is not denying that we experience transformation as our practice matures. There is progression from this moment to the next, but that passage comes about from interpenetrating connections. This passage of no passage from delusion to realization occurs because of an interpenetrating, impermanent, discrete moment's intimacy with all being. That's that moment of being time, that pivot point. Thus, our focus is on the present moment's expression, not a model of sequential passage. We are embedded in what is arising in and with us, and not trying to conceptualize or compare our experience with the vermilion palace of our imagined realizations. So that's a summation of what we've been saying all weekend of Dogen. I think she does a really lovely job there. You want to hear that again? Sure. Dogen is not denying that we experience transformation as our practice matures. We can see that. We can see it in each other. Those of us who have practiced together for some years, you see it seeping in. You see it expressed in how somebody rings the bell. You can see that. I can see that. And I love seeing that. I love the blundering ouches on the bell when someone first starts, and how beautiful it sounds 6 months later, right? Because that's that moment and that's that moment, right? Sure, it changes. There is progression from this moment to the next, but that passage comes about from interpenetrating connections. This passage of no passage from delusion to realization occurs because of an interpenetrating, impermanent, discrete moment's intimacy with all being. Thus, our focus is on the present moment's expression, not a model of sequential passage. We are embedded in what is arising in and with us, and not trying to conceptualize or compare our experience with the vermilion palace of our imagined realization. Yeah, you know? So that means sometimes we're in the mud. That moment's in the mud. And there's a vividness about that too, you know, right there. So this this very particularity of our impeded relative lives, right? You know, we all feel impeded, right, at times, is what opens our Dharma eye. That's where the pivot is. This is the nature of living reality. It's how we meet each moment. So that's where he says, you know, someone, thus you go out and meet someone. Someone meets someone, you meet yourself. Going out meets going out. But, you know, that's, we meet the next moment, whatever that is, whatever that. And that's how we awaken, as Buddha and Buddha, when hindrance drops away. When hindrance, that's the Heart Sutra is telling us. Without hindrance, there is no fear. In that moment, it pivots, right? Okay, so now Dogen goes for the summing up. Yeah.
Why was it translated as fulfilled here?
Like, darned, I would love to ask Kaz. I will.
Kaz did that translate.
Yeah, why he chose fulfilled.
He's just trying to be positive. He tries to always. No, I'm serious. But that's what he does with a lot of his translations. He tries to show the positive side of things. So, hindrance is too negative for him.
we'll wait till we hear from Kaz.
But if hindering opens the Dharma eye, then it is fulfilling.
In a curious way. But
yeah.
But the word, I think we can be true to the word. It is confused. His aim is not to be positive, but to be accessible, to make Dogen accessible. So hearing that as hindrance is actually confusing, right? Until you kind of parse it out, what the context is. It's that... It's the relative, from the point of view of the relative, there's hindrance. And simultaneously, the hindrance drops away. And that's the pivot. I think fulfilled is an interesting choice there because of that. But that's not what it says. But you can see how it, You can see a certain logic to it, yeah. Okay, so let's read the paragraph that says, mind is the moment of actualizing. Somebody? Pat.
Mind is the moment of actualizing the fundamental point. Words are the moment of going beyond, unlocking the barrier. Arriving is the moment of casting off the body. Not arriving is the moment of being one with just this, while being free from just this. In this way, you must endeavor to actualize being time.
Thank you. So mind. Our intention is the moment of actualizing our practice, and words is the expression, the moment of unlocking the barrier. Arriving is the moment of casting off body and mind, he's saying. That practice, realization, and actualizing are not separate, but arise in this moment of being time. And yet, even not arriving, even our moments as three-headed, eight-armed asuras are moments of being one with this moment just as it is. And in that moment, there is the possibility to awaken. And this is how we live and actualize, here's that word again, actualize being time. So, Dogen says, the old masters have uttered these words, but is there nothing further to say? And of course, he does want the last word. You should say, mind and words arriving partially are being time. Mind and words not arriving partially are being, he's giving one more tetralemma, right? Mind and words not arriving partially are being time. Further, you should examine being time. To have him raise the eyebrows and blink is half being time. To have him raise the eyebrows and blink is the being time missed. Not to have him raise the eyebrows and blink is half being time. Not to have him raise the eyebrows and blink is being time missed. Thus, to study thoroughly coming and going and to study thoroughly arriving and beyond arriving are the being time of this moment. So that's his last word, his one more tetralemma. To remind us that even, I think his point here with the half, you know, the half being time, just like it was with the, he said the half before, is to remind us that even when our realization and expression are only partial, you know, who of us is completely realized? Of course we're partial. Most of the time. Imperfect, impeded, you know, in our relative ordinary daily life. That too is fully being time. Fully being time, fully connected. We are all three-headed, eight-armed asuras and 16-foot golden Buddhas, and our wholehearted practice as imperfect half bodhisattvas matters. That's his point. To all beings. Whether we even know it or not, whether we know it or not, it matters. Our life, just as it is, matters. He doesn't come out and say it, but that's what I think is his purpose in all this. Is to say your practice makes a difference. And everybody else's does too and supports you. And all beings make a difference. So, I hope you found this not only thoroughly confusing, but encouraging. But encouraging. So what I'm going to ask you to do to wrap up is to write your own tetralemma. It's not a test. You don't have to. But think of a dilemma. Think of, you know, think of the... two alternatives, neither one is satisfactory. You know, we face these things all the time, right? And just try writing out a tetralemma of it. And just see how it cracks it open a little. If you could really see... that each of these possibilities is a life moment in that will change, right? Just see what happens. If you look at one of your dilemmas in this way, okay?